Usually when you think about buying real estate, the anxieties are, well, they're pretty standard. You worry about hidden water damage or maybe a cracked foundation or
Right,
termites.
you expect the physical structure of the house to be the biggest risk.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you get an inspection, you read the report, and you make this rational, heavily leveraged financial decision based entirely on the bricks and mortar.
We really do treat it as a highly quantifiable transaction. You are buying a physical asset that occupies a specific geographical coordinate. And as long as the roof holds up, well, the investment feels secure.
But then you encounter a case that just completely shatters that illusion. A case where the physical structure is perfectly fine, but the invisible environment around it turns a sanctuary into an absolute living nightmare. So, welcome to the deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Today, we are looking at an official 22 judgment from the Supreme Court of Western Australia. The source material is the case of Philogratnam v. Doan. And our mission today is to explore what happens when the ancient legal principle of buyer beware collides head-on with a literal neighbor from hell. We're going to unpack the surprising and frankly terrifying legal and financial ripples of failing to disclose material facts in a real estate transaction.
It is a wild ride.
Okay, let's unpack this because Supreme Court judgments are usually incredibly dry. They are these technical, dense documents full of statutory references that frankly put most people to sleep.
Oh, absolutely.
But this one, delivered by Justice Kerthoise, it reads like a dark tragicomedy.
It really does. Visually, if you could just see my backdrop right now, picture a massive, pristine stack of dense, intimidating legal briefs sitting right next to a chaotic, vibrating, noise-filled apartment building. That juxtaposition is the core conflict here. Yeah, so in 2015, a young professional named Sarah Thillagratnam bought a ground floor strata unit in Perth for $390,000. She bought it from the sellers, a Mr. Doan and Mrs. Nargian. She thought she was buying a refuge.
But she didn't.
No, instead, she bought a psychological prison.
And to really understand the gravity of it, we aren't going to start with the real estate listing. We are going to start at the very end of the story with the judge's own opening words.
Yes, the judge opens the entire ruling with a remarkably blunt, stark warning. Sentence number one is literally, "This case illustrates the folly of litigation."
The folly of litigation. I mean, that is an incredibly sobering thing to hear from the presiding judge at the end of your 5-day Supreme Court trial.
Oh, completely. And the financial reality laid out in the judgment reveals exactly why the judge was so frustrated. The sellers, Mr. Doan and Ms. Nguyen, are private individuals who operate a fish and chip shop.
Okay.
Before moving into the unit, they were unemployed. To even afford their legal defense for this massive trial, they had to sell their actual family home.
Wait, really? They had to sell their home.
Yes. And the judge explicitly notes that if they lose this case, they are looking at complete bankruptcy.
Oh man, so the sellers are facing total ruin. But surely Sarah, the buyer who was genuinely wronged here, walks away with a massive victory, right? Like she gets her justice.
Well, the judge points out that even though Sarah technically wins the case, the defendant's likely bankruptcy means she is going to be left with a massive, unrecoverable legal bill from her own lawyers.
You're kidding.
She spent years fighting, hundreds of thousands of dollars on legal fees, and is left holding a judgment against people who have nothing left to give her. It is just the bleakest possible outcome for everyone standing in that courtroom.
It's a complete Pyrrhic victory. It's like surviving a horrific shipwreck, swimming for days, and finally dragging yourself onto the beach, only to realize you are stranded on a deserted island with no food or water.
That's exactly it.
Sure, you survived the trial, but if the people you sued have no money to pay you, you get nothing but a piece of paper and devastating legal bills, which forces us to look at the massive systemic failure here.
Right.
If the neighbor was the one causing all the problems, why didn't they just sue the actual bad guy?
And the judge expressed deep frustration over that exact point. The neighbor causing the nightmare, a man named Lawrence Pratt, wasn't even a party to the lawsuit.
That is just wild to me.
I know. And the legal system actually has tools for this. Had the buyer sued Mr. Pratt directly under the tort of nuisance, the court could have issued injunctions restraining his behavior.
Oh, right.
If he violated those court orders, he could have faced contempt charges, massive fines, or even imprisonment. Nuisance law is designed specifically to stop people from interfering with your quiet enjoyment of your land.
But I mean, property law and contract law are so much easier to trigger, aren't they? Suing a volatile, unpredictable neighbor for nuisance sounds dangerous and exhausting.
It does.
Suing the people who signed a piece of paper guaranteeing a peaceful apartment probably feels like a cleaner administrative process.
That is the tragic irony of the justice system in this scenario. Contract law is remarkably efficient at bankrupting people who sign a piece of paper, while nuisance law can be incredibly slow and difficult when trying to stop a man with a hammer. So the buyer chose the path of the contract, leading to absolute financial ruin for herself and the sellers, while the actual wrongdoer, Mr. Pratt, just carried on living in his upstairs apartment, completely insulated from the entire Supreme Court drama.
Unbelievable. So, to understand why the buyer felt so trapped that she went after the seller so relentlessly, we have to look at exactly what was happening inside that ground floor unit, Lot 6.
Right. Yeah.
How bad does a neighbor have to be to completely unravel a $390,000 real estate transaction?
Well, Lawrence Pratt owned Lot 16, which was directly above Sarah's ground floor unit, and he had lived there since 1980. The evidence of his antisocial behavior presented in court is just staggering.
Yeah, he had a history of violence restraining orders dating all the way back to 2001.
Exactly. A previous tenant who rented the unit before Sarah bought it, Eoin Carroll, testified that it was the worst place he'd ever lived. He had to call the police an average of once a week for 8 months.
Once a week. And it wasn't even triggered by loud parties. Mr. Carroll testified that they couldn't make basic, normal household noise without Mr. Pratt retaliating.
Yeah, if he saw you, he would scream abuse. If he couldn't see you, he would turn his music up to a ridiculous level or start violently hammering on his floor, which was their ceiling, causing the entire apartment to reverberate.
And when Sarah moved in, the abuse escalated into a systematic campaign of harassment. The court documents detail how Mr. Pratt would bang a hammer on his floor for up to 45 minutes straight.
45 minutes.
And the triggers were things like Sarah turning on her shower in the morning or using a hairdryer. As soon as she would leave for Herrick, he would scream obscenities from his balcony at her, calling her a lunatic, a moron.
The psychological toll of that is devastating. She testified that when the hammering started, she would go into shock and shake uncontrollably for 10 minutes.
Oh my God.
She suffered severe depression. She began experiencing hair loss from the stress. And eventually, she just abandoned the unit entirely. She left a $390,000 asset sitting completely vacant because she physically could not endure living in it.
Which brings us to the seller's defense. This is where the legal battle really hinges. Mr. Doan and Ms. Nguyen lived in that unit for 14 months before selling it to Sarah. And their primary defense was simply claiming they had no idea Mr. Pratt was this bad.
Right.
Mr. Doan actually sat in the witness box and testified that Mr. Pratt was, quote, quite a normal person, and that this whole situation was just a normal neighborhood dispute.
Yeah.
That is like standing in the middle of a Category 5 hurricane, watching houses get ripped off their foundations and telling someone, oh, it's just a bit of a draft. You cannot classify a grown man hammering your ceiling for 45 minutes because you dried your hair as a standard neighborhood disagreement.
What's fascinating here is how the judge dismantles that defense without relying on emotion, just using nothing more than basic human logic and the seller's own paper trail.
Yeah, they tried to downplay it.
The sellers tried to downplay their experience, claiming they only had three minor incidents with Pratt, one involving a meat mincer and another when they used a vacuum cleaner, which provoked Pratt into hammering on the floor.
But the court looked at emails the sellers themselves had sent to the strata manager months before the sale.
Exactly. In one of those emails, the strata manager notes that Mr. Doan called them highly distressed because Mr. Pratt was swearing, smashing the floor with a hammer, and literally stalking his wife while she was hanging out the laundry.
And the police incident reports showed the sellers told police their own children were terrified.
So the judge used an unassailable piece of logic in the ruling, stating, you do not react to the conduct of a normal person by calling the police.
Right. A normal person doesn't terrify your children.
Exactly. The court concluded, as a matter of absolute fact, that the sellers knew exactly how extreme Pratt was, and they deliberately chose not to disclose it to the buyer.
So what does this all mean legally? Because if the sellers never actually lied to her face, like, if they just kept quiet and let her buy the place, why isn't this covered by the concept of buyer beware? How did their silence cross the line into a legal violation?
The entire case revolves around a standard clause in the Western Australian General Conditions for the Contract of Sale, specifically Clause 10.2C.
Okay.
By signing the contract, the seller legally represents and warrants that they do not know of anything which will materially affect the buyer's use or enjoyment of the lot.
Okay, I want to reason through this on behalf of the listener. The sellers, Mr. Doan and Miss Nguyen, were relatively recent immigrants. They had a poor command of English.
That's true.
There is a very high probability that they never read the fine print of that massive real estate contract. They likely just signed where their real estate agent pointed. Is it fair for the legal system to hit them with fraudulent misrepresentation for simply remaining silent about a bad neighbor when they didn't even understand the warranty they were signing?
It is a harsh reality, but the judge addressed it directly by citing a foundational contract law precedent in Australia, Toll v. Alpha Farm.
Right.
The rule in contract law relies on objective intention. If you sign a document that is intended to have legal effect, the fact that you didn't read it or didn't fully understand the language offers zero defense.
Which makes sense. The legal system couldn't function if people could invalidate contracts simply by claiming they didn't read them.
Exactly. So by signing those settlement documents, they legally, objectively represented to Sarah that they knew of nothing affecting her use and enjoyment. Ignorance of the clause doesn't protect them.
Wow.
And the judge found that their silence wasn't just a passive breach of contract. It escalated to fraudulent misrepresentation.
Because fraud requires a false representation made knowingly, right, or recklessly.
Precisely. Recklessly, without caring if it's true or false. Because they desperately wanted to offload the unit, and they knew that disclosing Mr. Pratt would blow up the sale, they recklessly signed that warranty. In the eyes of the court, their calculated silence transformed into an active, fraudulent lie.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because Sarah also tried to sue them under the Australian consumer law for misleading or deceptive conduct, and that claim actually failed.
Yes. The judge completely threw out the consumer law claim, which is a vital distinction for anyone buying or selling property. Section 18 of the consumer law strictly prohibits misleading conduct, but only if it occurs in trade or commerce.
Wait, but the sellers originally bought the unit as an investment, right? They rented it out to tenants for years before they lived in it themselves. Why doesn't that count as commerce?
The distinction comes down to the fundamental purpose of consumer protection laws. Those laws are designed to correct the power imbalance between highly resourced corporations and everyday consumers.
Okay.
They hold businesses to a much higher standard of disclosure. But the judge ruled that a private individual selling a single residential home to another private individual is merely realizing a capital asset. It is a peer-to-peer transaction.
Even though they rented it out previously?
Right. Even though they had previously rented it out, they weren't property developers or running a continuous commercial enterprise. Therefore, the sweeping protections of the state's consumer law simply do not apply.
That is a critical warning for anyone entering the housing market. You do not have the same safety net buying a house from a family that you do buying a television from a retailer.
Very true.
So because the judge found the sellers liable for breach of contract and fraud under common law, the court had to figure out a remedy. They had to determine how much financial damage Mr. Pratt actually inflicted on the value of the property.
Valuation dilemma. When a property has a defect, standard damages are usually calculated by finding the difference between what the buyer paid and what the property is mathematically worth with the defect included.
But how do you calculate the economic depreciation caused by a hostile human being living upstairs?
Well, you bring in the highly paid real estate valuation experts.
And they failed spectacularly. Both sides brought in experts to present economic models to the judge, and both models just fell apart under scrutiny. Let's look at the seller's expert, Mr. Leeske.
Yes, he tried to apply what's known as a Stigna discount of 10 to 25%. To justify this number, he looked for comparable sales of properties with known stigmas.
And his comparable sales were properties located near noisy, heavy traffic highways.
He tried to argue that Mr. Pratt screaming obscenities and hammering on the floor was financially equivalent to living near traffic noise.
The judge saw right through that. I mean, traffic noise is passive. It is a general environmental factor that doesn't actively hate you.
Exactly.
Traffic doesn't wait in silence for you to turn on your hairdryer so it can intentionally ruin your morning. It's an absurd comparison. But then we looked at the buyer's expert, Mr. Moore. He argued the unit was entirely uninhabitable. And his comparable sales were properties where corpses had been left decomposing inside for extended periods.
He was trying to find a comparable for an extreme psychological stigma. But again, a tragic incident involving a deceased person in a house is static. It is entirely in the past. Mr. Pratt was an active, ongoing, unpredictable threat.
Moore also tried to create this bizarre mathematical formula based on Mr. Pratt's lifespan, right? The life tenancy calculation.
Yes, he looked at the Australian Bureau of Statistics life expectancy tables. Since Mr. Pratt was around 65 to 70 years old, Moore calculated he was statistically likely to live another 20 years.
And he then assumed the unit would be completely vacant and unrentable for those entire 20 years, modeling the financial loss based on 20 years of zero rental income.
You literally cannot apply a 20-year depreciation schedule to a human being's life expectancy.
It's wild.
And the judge rejected that model entirely. The reasoning really highlights the limits of economic theory. You cannot apply general statistical models to a highly specific, unpredictable psychological reality.
Right.
Yes, Sarah found the unit terrifying and uninhabitable. But a 20-something-year-old male buyer might have a completely different psychological response. He might simply yell back at Pratt or immediately take Pratt to court for nuisance, neutralizing the threat.
So you cannot mathematically prove the apartment is inherently worthless to every single potential buyer on the market for the next two decades just because Pratt is alive.
Exactly.
So if the experts can't give the judge a spreadsheet proving the lost value, standard damages are off the table. Does the judge just throw their hands up and say, sorry, Sarah, without a math formula, you get nothing?
No. Because the breach was so severe that it destroyed the entire fundamental purpose of the contract, and because it was rooted in fraudulent misrepresentation, the court turned to a powerful, equitable remedy called rescission.
Rescission. It's essentially a legal time machine. It doesn't just compensate you for a broken contract. It completely unbakes the cake.
I love that phrase.
It rips the contract up and forces everyone back to the exact positions they were in before the document was ever signed in 2015.
The legal term is restitutio, in integrum restoring the parties to their original state. Sarah is ordered to transfer the physical deed of the property back to the sellers.
And in return?
In return, the sellers are ordered to refund her the entire $390,000 purchase price, plus the stamp duty, the strata levies, and the massive interest costs on her mortgage for all those years.
Wow. And didn't Sarah spend nearly $30,000 renovating the unit?
She did. And even though she spent all that money renovating, the judge ordered the reversal because the renovations only improved the property the sellers were getting back.
But wait, this brings us back to the massive logical contradiction we discussed at the beginning.
Yes, it does.
If the judge orders the sellers to pay back almost $500,000, but these are unemployed fish and chip shop owners who had to sell their family home just to afford the trial, how do they pay? How does that actually work?
This is where we have to separate a court judgment from the reality of enforcement. A judge's order is, ultimately, just a piece of paper declaring who owes what. The court does not magically produce the funds.
Right.
When the sellers inevitably cannot pay the $500,000, Sarah has to enforce the judgment. That means initiating bankruptcy proceedings against them. A trustee will be appointed to seize whatever meager assets the sellers have left, liquidate them, and give Sarah whatever pennies on the dollar remain.
So even with the ultimate legal victory, even with the judge unbaking the cake, Sarah is still structurally ruined. The money simply isn't there to make her whole.
Exactly. The reason the judge called it the folly of litigation. It is a catastrophic loss of wealth across the board.
There is one final detail in this case, a real cherry on top, that perfectly encapsulates the mindset of the sellers and proves just how deceptive this whole transaction was.
The courtyard.
The courtyard. The entire reason Sarah picked this specific ground floor unit was because the real estate listing prominently advertised a huge secure courtyard at the rear, which she thought would be perfect for her dog.
During the trial, it was revealed that shortly after the sellers originally bought the unit, they had simply hired a contractor to build a fence over the common property of the apartment complex.
Oh my gosh.
They didn't seek permission from the strata company. They illegally enclosed land that belonged to all the owners collectively and then actively advertised it to Sarah as a private, secure, titled courtyard.
So they lied by silence about the neighbor, and they actively lied about owning the land the courtyard was built on. It paints a vivid picture of a desperate attempt to offload a highly toxic asset at any cost.
And the ultimate cost was everything they owned.
So for you listening to this right now, the next time you're sitting at a massive mahogany table at a title company or clicking through a 50-page digital contract to buy or sell a house, stop. Pay incredibly close attention to the clauses regarding use and enjoyment. ask specific, documented questions about neighbors because, as this case definitively proves, silence isn't always golden. Sometimes staying silent about a material fact isn't just minding your own business in the eyes of the law, it is outright fraud.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, there is a profound philosophical dilemma here that the legal text wrestles with but can never truly resolve.
Yeah.
We treat real estate as a hard, objective, physical asset. We insure it, we borrow against it, we value it based on the cost of the bricks, the mortar, the square footage of the land, and the economic comparables of the surrounding neighborhood.
Right, we treat it like it has inherent worth.
But this case proves that a single, deeply troubled human being living 10 feet above your ceiling can render a nearly $400,000 physical structure completely unlivable. Which forces us to ask, does a residential property actually have any intrinsic value at all? Or is the entire concept of our home's value ultimately and precariously dependent entirely on the mental health, the goodwill, and the behavior of the strangers who happen to share our walls?
That is a terrifying thought. You might own the bricks, but you are always at the mercy of the invisible environment surrounding them. It really makes you look at those dense, dry legal documents in a whole new light, doesn't it?